ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Picture a cave. Inside, a prisoner's chained to a wall. They've been there since they were born. All they've ever seen in their lives is the blank cave wall with shadows flickering past. They believe, with total conviction, that the shadows are all there is to reality. Sounds weird? Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National, the panel show about the things we believe. And that's what Plato thought the prisoners would believe when he wrote it 24 centuries ago. That is, that all of reality was just the shadows they saw flickering on the cave wall. He suspected what today's God Forbid guests will spend an hour arguing about, that reality, the stuff you're sitting on, what you're breathing, what you're made of, might not be what it seems. Every civilization that's existed has asked itself the same question. What is actually real? Plato made the point that it's more than what we see with our eyes. Then came Newton. Reality became his clock with time. Then came Einstein. Time started to bend. And I won't even get into quantum mechanics where reality gets stranger still. So we welcome one of the world's finest astrophysicists who's just written the field guide to all this, Geraint Lewis, Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Sydney. His new book of many, The Shortest History of Reality. His old friend and former student, now astrophysicist himself, Western Sydney University senior lecturer, is Luke Barnes. Well, gentlemen, welcome back. Let's start at the very beginning. Before philosophy had a name, before there was mathematics, before religion even had a name. Geraint, your book opens more than 200,000 years ago with Neanderthals. Did they ask themselves, what is reality?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer because, of course, there are no Neanderthals around today. And we have to sort of picture what they could have been thinking about the world around them from what they've left behind. And what we find is that Neanderthals were one of the first human species to bury their dead. So they intentionally buried the dead, possibly with grave goods, flowers, etc., with their bodies. So they must have been thinking something about the world, and not just the world around them, but the world beyond. They must have had some sort of viewpoint that the person who had died was more than just flesh to them. There must have been not only the physical world around them, that they must have thought that there's something else going on out there, and they were trying to understand their place in that world.
The idea that what I see is not all there is.
That's right. This notion of that the fact that they had respect for the dead must mean that they saw themselves as more than just animals like the other creatures they could see in the field.
And Luke, does this surprise you that perhaps this, if instinct is the word for it, that there's something other than what we see?
No, because if you try to work out what's happening behind nature, as it were, if you watch closely enough, there are patterns that weren't obvious the first time you looked. So, for example, if you're trying to survive, you're trying to eat things, and at certain times of the year, you know, because of seasons, a certain food might be available in the river or at a certain tree or whatever. But if you can work it out, if you're very careful and you watch nature very closely, you'll notice that the stars in the night sky will tell you what time of year it is, which stars rise in the east on a certain night, tell you what day of the year it is. So if you watch the stars closely enough, you can work out when food's going to turn up. And that's a weird connection to make. But once you've made it, the idea that, oh, there's hidden patterns here. Now, that's not necessarily stuff you can't see. It's just connections between things you can see but you didn't notice. So once you've got a mind, a brain capable of making those sorts of connections, you then there's all sorts of motivations, you know, I'll eat better and survive better, to go looking for deeper connections around you.
and that pattern and connection that may have seemed crazy in the abstract the day before you made it seems obvious the day after you've made it. I mean, I wonder if you remember when you first realized as a child that there's more to the world than what I'm actually seeing right now. I can't, it's too early, but maybe in your education through your development, was there any aha moment?
Well, one of the big ones was, I think most physicists have this, when you start, you wouldn't get into physics if you weren't all right at mathematics. And at some point you start using these equations and realizing they're one step ahead of the world. You can actually predict things. That's a pretty amazing moment. And it never really wears off. Like one of the reasons why, you know, we do what we do.
You've got the bug, right?
Oh, absolutely. I was similar. When I was a young teenager, maths was this annoying, rote, learnt kind of stuff. And it was that connection between mathematics and equations and the ability to make predictions that, like Luke, absolutely wowed me that there's power in mathematics, that we can use this to say something about the world around us and what the world was like and what it's going to be like in the future.
So, Geraint, take me around the ancient world in 60 seconds. Egypt, Mesopotamia, Hindu, Buddhist ideas, they all had conceptions of the invisible.
Well, clearly this is something that comes with the rising of civilizations. That somewhere in our distant past, we started to ask these questions about ourselves, our place in the universe, and what is the universe for? And so in these ancient times, these were all essentially spiritual questions. And of course, all of these different societies, they came up with their own creation myths. They came up with gods to explain why this happened and that happened. And so, you know, in some of these sort of civilizations, the gods would meddle in your day-to-day activities. And there was a question that people would ask about, why do gods do this and why do they do that, etc.
There was a view that what we can see is an illusion. The world itself is an illusion. And this might seem sort of superstitious or primitive, but it's an ongoing, continuing question to this day.
Absolutely. I mean, you've already mentioned people like Plato and the notions that they had about the stuff around us. And is the stuff around us the real stuff, or is it a sort of projection of perfection? So we live in an imperfect world, but this is a projection of a more pure kind of existence that's out there. So of course, people were building up these philosophical ideas, and sometimes you'd find that societies would have similar ideas across different civilizations, but also they'd have quite different ideas. You know, in some societies, you'd have a notion that you'd have the spirit, which might be reincarnated, or that there's an afterlife, a soul, etc. So there's been lots of ideas that have grown up from a philosophical and spiritual approach to reality, but they're all essentially asking the same question, right? Here's a universe. I find myself in this universe. Why am I here? What's my role? Where do I fit into this thing called the universe? And so these viewpoints, of course, have been developed for maybe tens of thousands of years from our ancient ancestors. Some ideas have disappeared in the mists of time. Some of them are still with us today. Of course, modern religions are emerged from these very questions about our place in the universe.
And on one level, Luke, you know, we're on a steady progress of advance, like, oh, now we know more. They knew less. But there are areas and aspects of reality where it's not a straight line. Are there not?
Yeah, so I think we're still, someone summarized the history of philosophy as just footnotes to Plato and Aristotle. Like, we're still asking those questions. What's more real, or what we see, the appearances of the world, or is there something more real under the surface, which was sort of Plato's view? You know, the shadows that we see is just all the stuff we see around us, but there's a real, more perfect world behind it. If you're Aristotle, for example, you know, you see that down here on Earth, which is very much the bottom of the universe, there's change and decay and things come to a stop. But if you look up in the heavens, things go round in perfect circles, you know, day after day, night after night. So it must be more perfect up there. It's almost sort of half what we today, it's somewhere between philosophical and scientific. It's not purely scientific, of course. It's not what we do today, but there's something going on. So Aristotle's, you know, the more perfect as you go up, or the Plato's, the more perfect as you become more mathematical and abstract. And You know, we've watched the world a lot closer than they did for an awfully long period of time, but there's a central core of questions about, okay, do we really know what's really real now? I mean, we know what the appearances are. We've watched the cave wall. Plato would say even now we're still watching the cave wall. Science watches the cave wall, right? It's philosophy that's going to let you walk out of the cave into the sunlight. Is it? I mean, we're still asking that question.
And Luke, Geraint was going through the different ancient traditions. Let's get to the Hebrew Christian tradition. What changes? What's the idea there about reality?
One of the things that fascinates me is that these stories that are told seem to be trying to answer the other stories told. So Genesis is trying to answer another story. So if you should read the Enuma Elish. It's wonderful. It's the ancient Babylonian creation story.
But doesn't it begin with Genesis? If you're a believing Christian, there's no book before it, or you take a broader...
I think it's something that comes along later to yeah. Oh, we can go into the whole history of what I think about that, but I think it's something that is answering, if not things at the time, maybe you could say, you know, it's anticipating, but I don't know. Where the history is, I don't know.
But you don't mind taking that historical view of the history of human understanding of God, and that doesn't interrupt your Christianity?
No, I don't take that sort of view of it. But I think the lesson, it's there to teach a lesson. And so whereas in these other views you have there's already gods who are sort of pseudo-physical anyway, in that when they have a massive brawl, the winner takes the loser and splits it in half and makes the heavens and the earth, and then they're sick of caring for this earth. It's so annoying. Let's make humanity to look after this thing we made so we can go and do our godly things, right? And if you have that view of it, and then you read Genesis, it's just a remarkably different story with a remarkably different conclusion you're supposed to say about it. In Genesis 1, there's no bad guy. It's not a story in that sort of sense. Like there's no opposition, there's no fight. It's just actually, you know, the world is rational at its bottom because God made it the way God wanted to make it. So I find that view, if you'd asked all of the sort of makers of the scientific revolution in sort of the 15 and 1600s, why are you looking for patterns in nature? Well, we've found patterns already, and we think there's more out there because we think there's a mind behind it. So that's exactly what Newton says.
Well, let's fast forward to the ancient Greeks, Geraint. They turn up and try to add this thing called logic.
It's really, how are you going to understand the world? And there must be a structure in which you understand that the world works. And that logic, of course, evolves into essentially the framework of our mathematical understanding of the universe. So it's the start of that language with regards to what language do I use to describe the world around me? And it becomes a logical universe, that there would be rules that the universe follows.
So the Greeks didn't mean religion's illogical, let's look for an atheistic logical understanding. That's not what they meant by logic, and that's not what logic means.
No, it's not my area of expertise about exactly what the ancient Greeks thought.
Come on, astrophysicists.
There wasn't that much room in my education for ancient Greek philosophy, I'm afraid.
But the idea of structure, of rules. Let's get a real grip of what's real from the forms. A banana isn't really a banana.
This banana that I have in front of me, and sorry, I focused on a banana in the book because I felt that an apple had been done to death because of Newton, so I used a banana. So the question is along the lines of, right, I see a banana in front of me, you know, what is this banana? And the ancient Greek philosophy is that somewhere out there in the space of forms, there is this perfect banana. And what I've got in front of me is a projection of that perfection. It's an imperfect view of what that perfect banana is. And every banana that any human will encounter will be an imperfect view of perfection. And it's not just bananas, of course, it's everything that we see. Everything, in terms of the Greek philosophy, everything has its perfected form out there in this space of forms. And what we're seeing is just projections of that, and the projections are always imperfect.
So, Luke, what does a Christian reading of the visible world teach us?
It's really the early history of Christianity, the first couple of centuries there, where there's an awful lot of effort to say, okay, the Greeks have said this and that. There's Plato, there's Aristotle. I mean, the first 1,000 years really is how do we bring together these worldviews and say something sensible about them? So you have minds like, let's say, Augustine in the 5th century, probably the most famous Christian writer outside of the Bible, who is wrestling with Plato and his Christianity and trying to bring those together. Probably the other most famous one, moving ahead to the 13th century, is Thomas Aquinas, who's wrestling with Aristotle, even that long after Aristotle, and Christianity, and trying to think about how to bring them together within a worldview where it makes sense. I mean, it's part of Christianity to say that, you know, it's not an accident that my senses are here and they can make some sense of at least the appearance of the world. And there is a mind behind it. It's not an accident that we're here or that the world, the earth provides for us. How much we will get an insight into the deepest laws underneath the universe is an open question, but one that we're sort of invited to go after, given that, you know, understanding the world is something that we've been equipped to do.
Hmm. And Geraint, what do you think about the fact that religion got there first thousands of years before science, essentially exploring these same questions with less of a hard border, as Luke explains, than we would like to believe?
Got there first. That's an interesting way of putting it. I mean,
depends where there is.
It really depends on there. I actually think that curiosity about the natural world is something that our, you know, semi-evolved monkey brains have become very good at doing. And so I don't think it's necessarily that it was religion got there first. It's just that human curiosity has built over time and you put it into whatever worldview you have, right? And so in those early times, as Luke was mentioning, the people who had time to think about things, time to write things down, had time to philosophize, were, you know, often those people in monasteries and had lives that where they could spend time thinking about these things. So I actually think that's just part of the way we have evolved, is to have this natural curiosity. And what was purely in the philosophical and religious realm centuries ago has morphed into what we now call the scientific realm.
And would we be making a mistake if we said today, at least, there's a hard separation between the philosophical and scientific realms? Because I'm reminded you just, and Luke together, went to this European conference about panpsychism. What on earth are two leading astrophysicists doing at that? What is panpsychism?
Well, let's touch on the philosophy aspect first. There is a sort of frictional relationship between philosophers of science and scientists as well at the moment. So we don't really engage that much. The boundary between the two, some scientists stay far away from philosophy, some philosophers stay far away from science. There's very few occasions where we really get together. The reason we were at this conference, it was a philosophy conference, and both Luke and I were invited because one of the topics that philosophers discuss around this notion of cosmology, the universe, our place in the universe, are we somehow special in the universe? Is the universe made for us? This is in science, this is a topic known as cosmological fine-tuning, something that Luke and I have worked on from a scientific viewpoint. And the philosophers wanted to understand what the scientists thought about this particular topic. So we were there to basically give the scientific picture and to discuss the relationships between what we were finding in the science and what the philosophers were discussing. So from my point of view, I think I understood the science very, very well, but some of what the philosophers were talking about was a little bit mysterious.
How about you, Luke?
So I think panpsychism is relevant to what we're talking about. Now, I think we decided at the end of this conference neither of us buys it, but here's at least what it's trying to say. So we have this question of there's the appearance of the world, but what's really happening behind the scenes? And you might think, well, all we'll ever see is the appearance of the world. We can't get out of Plato's cave, right? He thought philosophy could do it, but, you know, science isn't going to do that. So what's really happening? And panpsychism says, well, hang on a second. There's one part of the natural world, that whatever's going on around here, that I'm inside, right? And that's me. I'm in here. And what's it like to be a physical thing Well, it's to be a conscious thing. I'm a thinking sort of thing, Descartes might have said. And so what panpsychism says, and there are some interesting threads throughout history of people who sort of doubled with this idea, and it's come to the fore in recent decades, is, well, what if to be a thing at all is to be a conscious thinking type of thing, right? That's the only view we've got of the inside of the world is us, and it's a conscious thing. What if everything's like that? And so the idea is maybe everything. What is it really? It's a thinking kind of thing, but a very basic thinking kind of. The water in this glass is a very basic conscious thing. And that, you know, and if you put enough of them together, you get a big thinking thing like me. Now, neither of us bought that, but that's the idea.
In other words, we just think maybe consciousness is this thing in the brain. It's much bigger than that. Consciousness must be somehow a thing in the brain, mind, and body. And you go, ah, consciousness is a property of the universe, a much more meta idea, which neither of you buy.
Well, I still think there's a big question about what on earth consciousness is. I mean, the idea that I have an inside view here is something to think very long and hard about especially whether there would be an inside view of anything if it's just atoms bouncing around, right? You know, there's this problem in philosophy of consciousness of philosophical zombies, as they're called. Could I take all of your matter and put a copy, exact copy of you over there, one meter to the right, but there's no consciousness there? It's just it's like this computer. The computer's not aware of things in any sense, right? If I made a copy of you, would another consciousness turn up? And that's an open question. If it's possible to have your arrangement, but no one's inside there, no one's awake in there, then how are you awake? Like, what's going on around here? So that's the hard problem of consciousness. Why did anyone wake up rather than just have atoms that play out?
Okay, well, I'm James Carlton. This is God Forbid on ABC Radio National, the panel show about the things we believe, and we're learning what two astrophysicists believe, Luke Barnes and Geraint Lewis. Geraint's latest book, just out, The Shortest History of Reality. Coming up, what it means when Isaac Newton turns the world into a clock. Okay, Geraint, take us through the next stage of scientific advancement, Newton's clock taking us into Einstein's understanding of time. What does this teach us about what is real, what is reality?
Well, let's start with Newton and Galileo and the thinkers of the day, right, where the birth of the scientific revolution, when we really started to take these patterns that we see in the natural world and we relate them to mathematics that we can write down. And when you work with Newton's equations, right, they're equations that really tell you about positions and velocities and accelerations. And so it's really about where something is and how is it moving. And how is it moving is how is it changing its position with respect to time. So you need to have a picture of both space and time for you to understand what these equations actually mean. What are they telling you? So there had to basically be a decision on what space and time mean here. And effectively, one way you can look at it is that space is like the stage on which physics is set, right? So you have this notion of space, you have up, down, left, right, forward, backwards. But you also need a time. You need things to change over time, right?
10 kilometers an hour.
Yes, absolutely. So Newton's version of this time is that this time is universal, that, you know, you can imagine that somewhere in the universe there's a secret clock ticking away 1 second per second, and all across the universe, all other clocks, and that's not just mechanical clocks but biological clocks, right? You have a biological clock ticking in your body, all ticks away in sync with this sort of universal time. And so that view that essentially, if you're going to have a universal time and you're going to say that everything ticks with regards to that time, the picture that starts to emerge is, of course, this notion of a clockwork universe, right?
Was that a big idea at the time?
At the time, I have a big idea. I mean, these ideas take time to take hold. I mean, I think Newton's more radical idea was this notion that the laws of physics that I see here on the Earth, the apple that falls from the tree, those laws are universal. They extend from the surface of the Earth and out into the universe. And he was the first to say that the motion of the moon was governed by the same laws as the apple falling from the tree, this notion of gravity. And so from that, if you're going to say that I can predict exactly how an apple is going to fall from the tree, and I can use the same equation to tell me about how the moon orbits the earth and the earth orbits the sun, et cetera, all the way out into the universe, you essentially have a clockwork universe. The universe plays along to the equations that you've written down. The patterns aren't being driven by some mysterious forces. It's just the laws of the universe playing out as the universal clock ticks.
Hmm. And he saw this as, I guess, God's clock. He was a religious man. This universal time would have been God's good time.
But he was at a time when everybody was a religious person. And in fact, not being a religious person could get you into an awful lot of trouble. But I mean,
Halley wasn't. I looked into this, and Edmund Halley, I tried to find an exception to that, and I only found one of them. Edmund Halley, who famously used the laws to predict that his comet would come back, the one named after him. But yeah, you're right. I spent ages trying to find someone, and I eventually found someone who wasn't a believer.
Would be an irony if the atheist Halley proved that the comet came back only to learn that God came back after he died.
Well, he knows now.
Yeah.
Or not, as the case may be.
Yes. But just to point out that his comet did come back, just like clockwork.
Just like clockwork. But he was wrong, though, about universal time, which takes us to Einstein and time, who people still argue about whether he was an atheist or not. He was an atheist, but not an atheist. Have I got that right?
I mean, he was Jewish, but his faith wasn't necessarily at the forefront of his day-to-day.
He said God hides behind coincidences. I don't know what that means.
I think he often, there's also a famous saying, God doesn't throw dice.
Yeah.
But I think he just means like ultimate reality. Yeah. I think it's a metaphor.
Yeah.
But so Newton's equations held essentially for two centuries up until the start of the 20th century, which is when Einstein essentially burst onto the scene. And in 1905, he gave us his special theory of relativity. And through the 1800s, people had been trying to understand electricity and magnetism, right? So they were the cool things to do, 1700s into the 1800s. And James Clerk Maxwell, a Scottish physicist, was the one that worked out that light is comprised of electricity and magnetism basically working together. But there was problems with the equations. There were problems with the speed of light because speeds in the universe are relative to things, right? So if I'm talking about how fast something is moving, I have to say what it's moving with respect to. So if I'm sitting on a train with Luke, we are moving at the same speed and we're at rest with respect to each other, but somebody who sees us from outside the train sees us speeding past at 100 kilometers per hour. So the question was, the speed of light that was found in the equations that Maxwell gave us, what was it relative to? And people had come up with all kinds of strange ideas in the late 1800s to try and explain this. But Einstein basically threw out the rule book, right? He essentially said, well, I can make this work, but what I have to do is I have to get rid of Newton's notion of space and time. I have to make those things flexible. So if you make your clock flexible and space flexible, then you can ensure that everybody sees light move with the same speed because everyone's got different rulers and different clocks. And, you know, it's a kind of shocking kind of statement. And I sort of remember thinking about this when I first learned special relativity, thinking, this is weird. I mean, how do clocks do this? Because I know clocks. I've got a little clock on my wrist, etc. What does this mean? And essentially what it boils down to at the end of the day, when you think about it, is that there's a personal experience of the passage of time, right? In that, for me, time passes at 1 second per second. But for Luke, time also passes for him at 1 second per second. But if he watches my clock and compares it to his clock, that they're no longer in sync. What is a second for him doesn't look like a second for me. So time becomes this relative thing, which is a very strange thing to basically get your head around, really, at the end of the day, is that everyone's experienced time the same, but our clocks are all out of sync depending upon our motion and where we are with respect to gravity.
Geraint did a good job of it, but explain how you're looking at his watch is relatively different to his looking at his 1 second of time.
It's so basic and so deep in the structure of the universe that there's nothing sort of more basic to explain it in terms of. This is space and time themselves. This is what they're like. I mean, eventually science, you get to And you end up, and that's the way things are. I mean, there are chains of explanation beautifully. You know, there's this sort of rational order behind the universe, but at any particular time, the science lands somewhere in a, this is the way things are.
But your second and my second, let's look at our watch now. Aren't we having identical experiences looking at our respective watches?
What Einstein worked out was, okay, if I want to compare my watch to your watch, well, if yours is over there and mine is over here, we're going to have to send something between them, or I'm going to have to bring mine over, or yours is going to have to come to me. We've got some more moves to do. And what Einstein had worked out is if his idea of the universe is right, and it's the one held up by, you know, experiment, the process of either bringing the watches together or sending a light ray between them, it means that it's off. The motion will change very slightly. It's not going to affect us here in the room. But if two clocks are moving relative to each other, then when you do the work of actually getting them and comparing them, they're not the same.
Yeah, it takes time to get from your time to my time.
Well, most importantly, it takes speed for me to get to you. And once you start moving around, things get weird.
Not long after this, as if the world didn't have enough time to get its head around these concepts, and then came along, you talk about in your book, the paradox. Was it Bohr's paradox?
I mean, I think you're talking about the Bohr-Einstein battle, essentially. So this is related to the development of quantum mechanics. So we are going to have to say the Q word, which normally sends people running. But quantum mechanics is the rules that we found out for the universe on the very, very small. So when you want to talk about atoms, so you want to talk about electrons orbiting atoms, etc., you can't use the rules that Newton gave us, which describes planets going around the sun, to describe how an electron travels around an atom. It just doesn't work. Atoms would be unstable. So this entire language of quantum mechanics was developed to discuss the world of the atom. But the problem is that the language of quantum mechanics is not a language of this is exactly here and it's moving at exactly that speed, but it's got a probability of being here and it's moving with a probability of that speed. So it's a language of probability. And Bohr was one of the grandfathers of quantum mechanics. He was in, you know, boots and all. And Einstein recoiled from this notion that the universe is probabilistic. He liked the notion of a universe which is essentially a clockwork universe.
Why do you think he recoiled? Do you think it was the same way a scientist recoils at the prospect of a conference with a philosopher of science? Was it making him uncomfortable emotionally or scientifically?
I think probably a bit of both. I believe Luke is giving talks on God does not play dice, so maybe he knows what Einstein's particular feelings were.
Well, it's a very interesting history because it's been told in a couple of different ways. But ultimately, there's something called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, which is, and even then, it's paradoxically not a paradox. It's just an argument. But moving on. So it's important to say Einstein eventually, I mean, I think his instincts say if you see probabilities, what you've got is a system that's just not the final story. There's just something else to say. Rolling a dice and the probability of a six is one in six. Well, that's just because I don't know everything about how I rolled it. So I think there's his instinct. But he's eventually got an argument. And the argument is very simply there are correlations in nature. There are ways you can do an experiment where, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but you know there's a definite correlation. I don't know what this thing and that thing are going to do, but I know that together they're going to do something together. Basically, if one of them's up, the other one's down. If one of them's down, the other one's up. And Einstein says, okay, I've got an argument now. It's not just his favourite way of thinking about the universe. Is unless these things can talk to each other at more than the speed of light, there must be something we don't know about the universe that tells this one to go down and that one to go up, or that one to go up and that one to go down. And, of course, he's Einstein, so of course he doesn't think things talk faster than the speed of light. It's his theory that showed that that doesn't happen. And so he concludes, not there's this sort of picture of Einstein holding on to the old way and not embracing the new way. No, he's got an argument. It's a very good argument. It's still a good argument today that either things talk faster than the speed of light, which I think is actually the way things turn out true. I think Bell shows that in the 1960s. But Einstein doesn't believe that. Or there has to be something more than what quantum mechanics tells us. It's not all probabilities. There is some fact out there. We just don't know it.
Well, I think this notion, I mean, there have been Nobel Prizes given for showing that there are these correlations which cannot be explained by essentially things carrying bits of information. There must be something going on across the universe.
Remarkably, the press release for that Nobel Prize in 2022 got it wrong. It said that it's a theorem by John Bell, and it's confirmed experimentally by the people who got the Nobel Prize. And what it said was it shows that there are no hidden variables. What that means is there's nothing beneath quantum mechanics. The probabilities are the reality doesn't know what happens next because there are no hidden variables. There's nothing underneath to tell us. That's what they said. The press release said that's what these experiments proved, and they're wrong. That's not what Bell said, right? Bell, it's his theorem, dagnabbit. He unfortunately passed away.
But the press release lives.
But the press release lives, unfortunately. What Bell showed was that it's these faster-than-light correlations. They're not signals, right? This is the really weird bit. But there are ways that the universe is sort of strangely connected to itself and one thing can influence another faster than light.
But the important thing is you can't send information. That's the key point. So when people say faster than light, you think, oh, I can send a message faster than light. These correlations can interact faster than light, but you can't use them to send a message like instantaneously to Alpha Centauri.
How do they interact?
We don't know. Mysterious action at a distance. Again, when you get to the bottom, there's nothing below it to say how does that happen. Like if you say how does atoms work, I can talk about the stuff below, like below that, so to speak, like the protons do this and the electrons do that. Like how does this part of reality affect that part of reality? No, we're at that point in quantum mechanics, we're at the bottom.
But how do we know that's the bottom? There's not one beneath it.
So as according to the theory, yes, there might be more to reality, right? But we don't know. Like at the moment, if someone's got an idea, you know, come talk to us, that'd be great. But at the moment, you know, we have theories that predict this correctly. We have theories which are entirely deterministic, by the way, where there is a fact about what's happening and there's particles over here and there's waves over there and it's all, not. This is not the usual picture of quantum mechanics, but it is available if you want it, it's on the menu. But there's no sort of deeper why. There's this thing called the wave function, which is really out there and really does weird stuff faster than light.
Geraint, if this universe runs like a clock or a quantum clock, well, there are these faster than the speed of light correlations. Do we need a clockmaker, a correlation maker, or does this make the maker redundant?
Well, you know my particular background. I mean, if there is a maker, I'd like to understand why things have to be as complicated as they are at the basic level.
Yeah. And why did he get the press release wrong?
Well, there is that. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, you think he could have got that part right? So we have our. Well, one of the nice things about I think our understanding of reality is that it has become a story of essentially searching for simplicity at the bottom, okay? So, you know, we know that we're made of atoms and there are 92 natural elements in the universe. So it's not like there's Luke stuff and Geraint stuff and wood and plastic, etc. They're all made of atoms and all made of the same 92. But when we look deeper, we find that every atom is made of the same three particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons. And then when we get to the current bottom of particle physics, we have this like little menu of quarks and leptons and bosons, which the universe is constructed out of. And so the entire visible universe we see around us, I have this really small menu of things, and it's only a fraction of those that the visible universe is made out of, that are used to create everything. So there's a simplicity there. But it looks like a simplicity that comes from mathematical rules, in that there are groups of three. We don't understand why there are groups of three, but there are groups of three and there are pairs of quarks and pairs of leptons, etc. There's mathematics in there on numbers 1, 2, 3, etc., which looks like, I said, it's something that's emerged from a mathematical structure. So if you wanted to put a maker in there, I would say, well, the maker's designed the mathematical structure to look like this. But if I go and talk to a person working in string theory, and string theory is the idea to try and get things even more simple than what we currently have, so it's trying to look deeper than our standard model, they would say that, oh, that mathematic mathematics emerges from the way that the universe was born. The universe gets imprinted with a set of laws when it sort of crystallizes out of whatever the universe came from. So there's no maker writing down the particular mathematics of the universe. It's just that, again, a roll of the dice has given us a particular set of mathematics that underpins the universe.
It might be as simple as that, Luke.
Well, this is the interesting point from my point of view. I don't know why, if there's just physical stuff around, why would it prefer to be simple? I'm coming around to the view that this idea that we should expect reality to be simple is Occam's razor, famously known as. Now, there's a methodological way of if you've got a bunch of things to choose between, you're allowed to pick the simplest one just for your own convenience. But there's another side of that, which is when we go and look out in nature, it really does look like there's a lot of simplicity around there where there could have been a lot more complexity. That rule, that methodological rule, which you're allowed to do, it actually sort of works out there in the real world, and it's helped us. And physical things can be complicated, so I don't know why reality would have a preference for simplicity. I know why we do, but why is this working? Why is it out there in the world? And I'm wondering, you know, I already believe in God, so I don't. There's a bias there, obviously. But when I try and put myself in the shoes of the naturalist, of the person who says that nature is all there is, why would nature prefer things to be simple rather than complicated? It seems like minds prefer things to be simple rather than complicated. This is what we do. I don't know if there's an argument there. It's just something about reality that sits comfortably with me. And I wonder, again, this is sort of me role-playing as something I'm not, and I'm not doing that very successfully, you know, at times, but I wonder if that would bother to keep me up at night.
On God Forbid, I am James Carlton. We are with the amazing Luke Barnes and Geraint Lewis. They're both astrophysicists. The book, The Shortest History of Reality, is the latest from Professor Lewis, though between them you must read A Fortunate Universe and A Cosmic Revolutionary Handbook. We are looking at reality, the history of reality and its future. What actually is it? The Last Frontier, up next. So reality, a wave function, a probability, a block of space-time with no true now. The next great frontier seems to be upon us or not. Artificial intelligence, which is intelligence or not. Is this going to be the next breakthrough in our understanding of reality or not?
Well, it depends who you talk to, right? So, I mean, we have some areas which are still outstanding when it comes to our appreciation of reality. And of course, one of the ones you've mentioned is consciousness. And there's a big question at the moment, of course, is consciousness, as we were relating to the panpsychism conference we went to, is it something fundamental, a property of the universe, and we've just got enough of it, so we are conscious beings? Or is it something physical? Is it just something that happens when you get enough complexity in one place? And so if you talk to people who study the brain, of course, we have trillions of neurons in our brains, and they're all set up in a very complicated network. And somehow, some people think that if it's just a physical thing, that the electrical signals surging through there give us consciousness and memory and all the rest of it that makes us sentient and understand the world around us. And the question is that if that is true of a wet biological network in my head, what if I build a metallic network and make it equally complex and start to put electronic signals through there? And I allow it to basically build connections in the way that neurons build connections in the brain. Does that mean that machines will become conscious? And if they do, then, it's a couple of things. Number one, will we even recognize it? I mean, if a machine says, oh, I'm alive, you know, do we go, oh, well, it's just the machine saying something, it's not really in there, it's not really thinking. But if it does, then what does that mean for us? And of course, in relation to the show that we're on today, in our place in the universe, if we can create consciousness out of complex networks, then does that mean that our consciousness is nothing particularly special?
And this metallic brain that you hypothesize, this could begin as a baby. We would put the consciousness, am I right, structure around it, and then it could learn like a baby, just as our wet brains, baby brains, enable us to grow into adult wet baby brains.
Absolutely. So, I mean, of course, the notion that we have of it, computer intelligence at the moment is AI and large language models. But we know that essentially if you want a large language model to work, it's got to suck in information and find some way of condensing and sorting and then making sense of it, and also but also and then releasing that information out when given the correct prompt. So LLMs are a software version of that kind of approach, but they're very inefficient. And the one thing that's kind of special about the human mind is it runs at relatively low power. You know, it's a 100-watt device. It's nowhere near the data centers you need for AI to work. But if you could build a network of wires, and you could run it on 100 watts, and it could run the same level of signals that you've got in your brain, it could do that thinking, it could do that learning, you could feed it stimuli, and it would build connections in there such that it would be able to, when it receives those stimuli again, have a particular kind of response, which is something that happens with us. So again, I don't think anybody really knows if, because, you know, the hard problem of consciousness, it means that we haven't solved it, but nobody really knows if we could ever have a complex network inside a machine. But I have spoken to people that think that it's something that's on the horizon.
Luke.
As someone who teaches first year university students, AI is not my favorite thing right now. I think it's a mistake and we should all go back. But anyway, join me in the revolution.
Did you have an anecdote about an essay or a...
Oh, I asked the class a question, and, you know, how do you learn about the world? Because, you know, we used to read newspapers and stuff, if you ever remember those. And these youngsters, how do they actually learn about the world? And one person in the room who had clearly just asked the question into AI and then just copy-pasted it. It's the most lazy thing I've seen in my life. But their answer was something along the lines, I have been trained on gigabytes of data from the, like, oh, come on, champ. Do me some... Anyway, for those reasons, I think it's a mistake and we should all go back.
But this, in a way, sheds light on this, because that's just cheating with a bad AI answer. When the AI answer becomes so good that it becomes indecipherable from the uncheated correct answer, cheating collapses on itself and we have two forms of consciousness.
This is really interesting to me as a physicist. So let me put this in the terms that we deal with. We run supercomputer simulations that try to make galaxies. You let the laws play out in a computer, and then when you're done, you go and look at it to see whether you made something that looks like our universe. And you have, say, a list of where all the particles are, the bits of the universe. And then you ask yourself a question like, where are the galaxies? And they're not immediately in the particles. You have to then go and ask a higher level question, like, is there a clump of them over here that are all held together by their own gravity? So that's an emergent phenomenon. Okay, so here's what's weird about that. If you think consciousness is that sort of thing, you put the right particles in the right order and then consciousness happens. The problem I have with that is when we analyze our simulations, I could do all of my analysis without ever using the idea of a galaxy because it's emergent. I could just know where all the particles are and then I'd know sort of everything that's there. This emergent idea is sort of our convenience. Unless you really thought the laws of nature cared about whether something was in a galaxy or not, which is not how we think of the laws of nature, but unless you're doing that, I can choose whether I want to talk about galaxies or not. That's just up to me. But I can't choose whether the universe has consciousness in it or not because I'm definitely in here. Like, I've not decided to view the universe in a conscious way. This emergence just seems like the wrong sort of idea because, like, I know something about consciousness beyond what physics could possibly tell me. I know that I'm in here. I'm not just, you know, it doesn't make any sense to say, you know, I decided that I would view the world as conscious. No, that's the first thing I know about reality. There's definitely a conscious being in reality. It's all this other stuff I have to learn about the other way. So this is why the hard problem is a hard problem, because the way we usually do things in physics looks like it's incapable of accounting for that fact. unless there's strong emergence, unless we've missed something. Like, these are the sorts of debates. These are why philosophy is ongoing.
Hmm. Is this the last frontier of reality, Geraint?
Firstly, we know that physics isn't finished. We know that it isn't solved. So, and annoyingly, after the 20th century, we still sit with two textbooks on our shelves for fundamental physics. We have Einstein's general theory of relativity to describe gravity in the large-scale universe, and we have quantum mechanics to describe everything that's going on in the small-scale universe. So there's been this search for the ultimate theory, the theory of everything, and that's been ongoing for like almost a century now. And some people will say to you that once we get the theory of everything, then all secrets will be revealed.
Or it might just be we've made the breakthrough, we understand quantum mechanics and its exact relationship with the laws of gravity, but we're still exactly at the same problem that Luke had a moment ago, the hard problem of consciousness. Yeah, is that the prospect?
Yeah, possible.
It's possible, but some people say there are plenty of people who think that quantum mechanics is related to consciousness, that probabilities in the mind are somehow related to your ability to think.
And do you think that's a scientific, plausible, probabilistic prediction, or more in the realms of the religious prediction?
There are some that definitely think that it's something purely physical, but of course there are others that think that the consciousness is something separate to your physical self. There is no single worldview across scientists and, of course, across people about what consciousness actually is. And, of course, that sometimes that leads us thinking that we're arguing about the same thing, but we're not. We're just using the same word. But I lean towards the it's purely physical kind of thing. I can imagine. I mean, I've looked at emergent phenomena. Complexity arises from the application of simple rules in complex systems, and I don't see why we should think that consciousness and our brains are necessarily different to the other kinds of complexity we see emerging in the universe.
Well, then finally, to you, Luke, you've both, each of you, spent 20 years as friends and co-authors and been exploring this exact same question. What happens when we get this theory of everything? Could that discovery, could that realization invite you to change your pre-existing view that it's not all physical, that there is more to reality than the observable universe?
I think the sort of answers we get from physics and the sort of answers I can even imagine from physics are ones that won't answer questions like, why is there anything physical at all? Now, there are some people who think it will, and there are some people who think that's not really a question, but I think that needs an answer. I think awareness, awakeness, you know, is just not the sort of thing that a physical, you know, I just can't imagine looking at a collection of particles and going, oh, that just woke up. I know what it is for, say, do a calculation or appear to be intelligent, but that this first-person experience that I'm having right now, I don't know what it would be to say that those particles are doing that. But again, what's going to happen tomorrow? I don't entirely know.
You will hear the news one way or the other on this program. It has been, God forbid, a most enjoyable episode, part of our History of series. We've had the history of feelings today, the history of reality. We touched on time, and we'll get into that in depth next week, the history of time. But for this week, I do want to thank our special guests, Luke Barnes. Dr. Luke Barnes, a senior lecturer at Western Sydney University and astrophysicist. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
And Geraint Lewis, Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Sydney. Thank you.
Thank you.
His new book, The Shortest History of Reality. You can follow and share, God forbid, on ABC Listen. Big thanks to producer Amanda Roberts, technical production Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid. We'll be right back.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.